Welcome to WISO Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Juliette Frumholt, filling in for Jerry Kenny. On today's program, WISO Curious investigates why Dayton has produced so many inventors and the first in a series of stories by this year's Community Voices training class. Bill Felker brings us Poor Will's Miami Valley Almanac, and Dan Patterson tells us about aviation in World War I. Up first, WYSO has been looking at water this month. And in Dayton, water is both an environmental issue and an economic one. Other parts of the country are facing major water shortages, and climate change is expected to make the heat and extreme dry conditions worse. That's bad news for states like California, maybe not for places with lots of water, like Dayton. Lewis Wallace took a look at why city officials here think Dayton might be sitting on blue gold.
First stop, a Dayton well field. I'm driving over a low bridge with Phil Van Natta, the head of Dayton's water treatment operation.
See the deer over there? Sitting on the ground.
This is a grassy island in the middle of the Mad River. The whole island is a well field.
There is a production well.
This is where Dayton pumps up groundwater from the Great Miami Buried Valley Aquifer. It's 1.5 trillion gallons that constantly recharges. This is the region's water source for just about everything. Once upon a time, industry lined the riverfronts around here. There were mills, factories, little breweries. Those days are long gone, says Van Atta.
We lost all the GM plants and the Delphi plants and parts plants associated with those plants.
Car manufacturing uses a lot of water. Now, dozens of out-of-use wells dot this island.
We've got loads of capacity now. We would love to see more demand, more industry come in, not just to increase our demand for water, but also so there are more jobs available to people in this area.
But that demand, it's not here yet. In recent years, the population has been basically flat or shrinking in places like Ohio, Illinois, and Michigan, where there's tons of water. And the biggest areas of growth are in the West and Southwest, where there's not. Peter Glick says that's a problem. He heads the Pacific Institute, a nonprofit in Oakland, California.
We're running into limits. The Colorado River no longer reaches the sea in an average year because humans use all of the flow. We're overpumping groundwater aquifers in the western U.S.
Parts of Texas have seen the worst droughts on record for 4 years and counting. California is facing much the same. It's affecting everything from food prices to the intensity of wildfires, and this might be only the beginning. Keywords, climate change.
Some of these southwestern cities that not only have water scarcity problems, but are going to start to see more and more costs for energy, for cooling, more and more uncomfortable extreme heat days. And in that kind of situation, I think it's possible that we may see a change in the kind of migration we've seen over the latter part of the 20th century, maybe back to some of these population centers in the Midwest and in the East.
Back to the Midwest. That's music to Karen Thomas's ears.
We have an abundant water source. We don't believe that we would have to worry about water.
She's the head of water marketing for Dayton.
Water is a public good, but it's also a commodity.
The vast underground aquifer, the Great Miami, is usually out of sight, but it's up to Thomas to make it visible and sell it. We're walking through the halls of the treatment plant, where the water glows bluish green as it's softened and cleaned in giant pools. Thomas is part of an economic development team, reaching out to food processors, manufacturers, beverage makers, any water-intensive industry that could use a cheap and abundant supply.
If they're looking for water, this would be a great place to relocate to.
They've already had serious interest from a few companies. Peter Kruger says he can see why. He's the master brewer at Bear Republic Brewery in California, north of San Francisco.
There was a period in early February where the governor listed 17 cities in California that were within 100 days of running out of water. And our brew pub in Healdsburg was one of those towns, and our production brewery in Cloverdale was another.
He says in the brewing industry, water isn't negotiable. This year has scared them, and so, believe it or not, they actually are considering a move to somewhere with plenty of water.
We have talked about other locations for a brewery that are not as water-stressed as California is.
They've looked at Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and yes, Ohio. But not so fast, says Karen Hobbs. She's with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
These are difficult economic times. But the troubling part about marketing water resources, I think, is that it tends to devalue that asset.
Hobbs thinks clean water in the Midwest comes too cheap. Plus, Dayton isn't immune to the effects of climate change, like drought or huge storms and floods, which can affect water quality and quantity. Point being, don't just move to where the water is. She says, first, reduce, reuse.
There's lots of low-hanging fruit in terms of improving water efficiency and increasing conservation that companies and individuals can take.
Peter Kruger says Bear Brewery has already done a lot to reduce its water use. And even though he'd hate to leave beautiful, sunny California, he has to get real.
Water's really going to be the challenge our kids and grandkids deal with. As there are more and more people, there's not going to be more and more water. There's going to be less and less clean water. And that's anywhere. That includes Ohio or, you know, the wettest place in the world.
Dayton isn't the wettest place in the world, but Karen Thomas, the water marketer, kind of wants you to think of it that way. The city may have lost jobs, people, whole industries, but that aquifer is still here.
We should never have to worry about water.
Thomas's message for the Peter Krugers of the world? Come and get it.
To be able to turn the faucet on, to get a cup of coffee, to flush your toilet, to take a shower, and the water's there and it's clean, why not love water? Especially Dayton water.
For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
This is WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Juliet Frumholt. Maya Nye is an Antioch College graduate who was working on campus in January of this year when a chemical spill in her home state of West Virginia left approximately 3,000 people without drinkable water. Nye returned to West Virginia shortly after the spill, where she serves as executive director for an organization called People Concerned About Chemical Safety. Maya Nye visited Yellow Springs this week for Antioch College's Global Seminar on Water and joins me here in the studio.
Months have passed. You know, mm-hmm. We heard a lot of news immediately in the weeks and the month following the chemical spill about the water situation, the drinking water situation for residents there. What's happening now? How are things going these days?
Well, you know, new information continues to come out. And, you know, it was on a daily basis, and now it's more like every couple of weeks. But over the last couple of weeks, we've learned that there was a hole in yet another tank that was containing MCHM by the United States Chemical Safety Board. They also believe that it was leaking prior to January 9th. So that opens up a whole lot of questions. You know, how long have people been exposed to this chemical in their drinking water? And additionally, some other information came out where a test was performed, and what they identified was that the chemical is actually 2 to 6 times more toxic than what was previously reported. So that's huge. You know, all of our public health decisions were based around perhaps wrong information. So now the Center for Disease Control is actually going to be testing this chemical. So that's just some of the most recent news. But I would say that most folks that I know still don't feel comfortable drinking the water or cooking with it. But for the most part, people have resumed their daily lives because they can't smell it any longer.
Now, there was a New York Times article that came out that talked about, and I believe NPR talked about this too, the economic strain on residents having to buy bottled water, modify their routines.
Sure.
Is a lot of that still happening, or are you just seeing the economic ripple effects of those families having to take all of these extra steps to be able to use water day to day?
I will say that every time I go to purchase water, because I am able to purchase water, the shelves are still fairly empty. The spring water is gone. The distilled water is still there, maybe some drinking water, but the spring water is practically gone. So I see that people are still using it. And it took a major toll on a lot of people. And, you know, some people were unable to either go out and purchase water or make it to some of the distribution points. So, you know, different people have had different experiences based on multiple issues.
Now, the Dayton community is very similar to Charleston in that, you know, we have water as a resource both for drinking water, but also for industry.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, a lot of question about whether, you know, in an area that's been hit so hard, that's had industry hit so hard, do we loosen our restrictions to get those jobs in here, or do we keep them as they are for drinking water protection? How has that conversation been happening, you know, prior to the spill and now in the days since the chemical spill?
Well, I would say that prior to the chemical spill, the conversation was much different. But when the chemical spill happened, I think that people who are not normally impacted by chemical disasters were impacted, and it affected them personally. And suddenly people felt, you know, what happens when you're unable to have that, you know, have that water to wash your hands with or make that cup of coffee in the morning. It really changes your relationship to it. So I think that after the chemical spill, we saw what happened as a result of deregulation and as a result of not protecting our water. So actually a lot of small businesses came out and spoke out about making sure that we need to ensure that we have clean water in order to enable our businesses to run. So now there's a really interesting conversation about, you know, who actually owns the water and who has the right to use it and in what ways.
Did you find that prior to this, that the average citizen didn't know a lot about where their water came from or potential hazards to their drinking water?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I just now learned where my drinking water source comes from in West Virginia. And that's ridiculous. You know, I'm 37 years old. I feel like I should have known that beforehand. And also because I am heavily involved in chemical safety and security work, I should have recognized that there was a chemical storage facility a mile and a half upstream of our largest drinking water intake in West Virginia. But because there are such other bigger hazards throughout the valley, it just sort of fell off the radar. So it just really acutely made us pay attention to what are the threats to our drinking water sources.
Now, for the average citizen, what would you say are some basic things they can do to become more educated about where their water comes from, potential threats near, you know, surrounding their water source, and how do you start to take action, you know, with your government or with your community?
I think the best thing to do is to really start asking those questions, you know, and finding out what is my watershed, where does my water come from, what are the headwaters of those, and then look at, you know, how is your community engaging in source water protection planning, and if that's not happening at a robust level, then it's time to start pushing for that, because you need to be, you need to identify what those threats are. It's actually been mandated by, I believe it was the Clean Water Act, but it was an unfunded mandate, so that's why a lot of sources of water are still in danger. But so really paying attention to that, working with their local emergency planning committees to help identify what some of those potential threats could be, and maybe joining some of those local emergency planning committees to identify ways to better mitigate potential contamination threats.
Maya Nye, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maya Nye is Executive Director of People Concerned About Chemical Safety and is a graduate of Antioch College. This is WISO Weekend. This week, we begin a series of stories by WISO Community Voices producers from the class of 2014. Our first story takes place in Yellow Springs, where Antioch College is creating an on-campus farm and building a solar array. The liberal arts college has a goal to create sustainable ways of living, but some villagers are unhappy with plans for the development of 35 acres on the south end of the campus. Antioch College student and Community Voices producer Wyatt Sowers has the story.
On May 7th, Antioch College had a community presentation on their controversial five-year plan to expand their farm and build a solar array onto the golf course. Yellow Springs residents have traditionally used the land as a place for open space. Antioch College President Mark Roosevelt began the presentation.
Good evening, and thank you for coming. I think I've learned that the secret to getting a good turnout at an event like this is to have a very large panel with a lot of family members.
The presentation started off on a lighthearted note, but once residents began to speak, things became somewhat heated.
I'm asking each and every one of you in here, how would you like to have cow and pig waste in your backyard?
That was Yellow Springs resident Betty Ford, and she wasn't the only one to speak out against the farm. Villager Steve Hetzler, as well as many others, were displeased with the college's plans.
But if you're going to put animals there, it's going to be unsightly, and they're going to have a cyclone fence around it, more than concrete, because pigs like to pig under fences instead of chickens.
The most controversial component of Antioch's vision for South Campus is the plan to put more animals on the farm. Right now, the college has about 50 chickens and ducks, as well as a small number of sheep. However, the college wants to get about 150 chickens and ducks, 40 ewes, 30 goats, 5 pigs, and 2 cows. The college also plans to expand its vegetable gardens and create a so-called food forest, which is a sustainable farming method that aims to replicate natural systems. I went out to the farm to see it for myself and talked to the manager, Kat Christian, about the farm and what it's going to look like if the college moves forward with its plans.
So those are the chickens. They're grazing on pasture. We just moved them to some fresh ground. And over here are the lambs that we got about 3 weeks ago, and they're also out grazing happily in the grass. Over there is where we'd like to put the solar panels. We're looking at about...
Antioch is planning on putting a 4.7-acre, 1-megawatt solar array onto the golf course as part of their goal to leave a net-zero carbon footprint. Some villagers are concerned that the array will create an industrial atmosphere around the golf course, but the college has plans to beautify it by putting art on the fence surrounding the array. The farm and the array will be open to the public via walking trails that will go through the golf course.
Accessible to the public along the trails and stuff. So it should be a really, really beautiful farm.
Antioch student, farm worker, and farm board member Marianthi Bickett is very happy to have a farm on campus.
It's really nice to be able to go out to the farm and be doing something that's really physical and like immediately gratifying, harvesting something that I'm going to go eat later in the dining hall. It's very cool.
However, some residents still remain displeased with the college. In fact, some of them have started a group called the Yellow Springs Open Space Coalition in opposition to the farm. I asked villager and coalition member Mike Kelly how the group feels about the college's plans for the golf course.
We have a very strong connection and a spiritual connection to the place, and the disruption with the cutting down of the trees and the large equipment is very disturbing for us. Our stance is we'd like to see it remain open and available to the public the same way it's been since 1930, which means we don't want a lot of large animals and we'd prefer not the solar array.
In order for Antioch to move forward with their plans for the golf course, they need to receive zoning approval from the Yellow Springs Planning Commission. On June 23rd, the commission approved Antioch's request to use 5 acres of the golf course for their planned solar array. Implementation of the solar arrays will begin soon. However, it is not currently known when and if Antioch will receive zoning approval to host large animals on the farm. The Yellow Springs Open Space Coalition is trying their best to prevent the college from hosting these large animals. Mike Kelly talks about their current plan.
We're going to continue to meet as an open space coalition and try and work with the village to make sure that the college follows all the applicable zoning laws.
It's not clear if the college plan for more animals on the farm will meet local zoning requirements, but whatever happens, the college has a long road ahead of it if it is to complete its plans for South Campus. Farm board member Nick Budis said,
"Rome wasn't built in a day, and you don't build and design and plan and implement a farm project like that in a day or even a year."
For YSO Community Voices, this is Wyatt Sowers.
Support for Community Voices is provided by the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation. For more Community Voices stories and information on our training program, visit wyso.org. This is WISO Weekend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the sixth week of Middle Summer. Markers for the transition week to August along the 40th parallel include the blooming of purple ironweed, the ripening of the first blackberries, the beginning of the passage of monarch butterflies, the flocking of starlings, and the start of late summer's night cricket song, the loud calls of katydids and elderberries darkening for wine. These events and so many others all happen at the same time. Their accumulation composing the exact color and scent and texture of this particular time of year. Of course, the butterflies do not cause the katydids and the crickets do not cause the ironweed to bloom. Nevertheless, all the developments of this week are related, and they're related in a synchronous web. They are meaningfully related. And if they did not occur in sync with one another, there would be no sixth week of Middle Summer, but something altogether different. The philosopher and psychologist Carl Jung used the word synchronicity to describe temporally coincident occurrences that may be related by their meaning. In everyday conversation, people speak of synchronicity referring to coincidences that seem too closely related to be just coincidences. In the context of nature, however, although nothing may occur without cause, the days themselves are formed and defined from temporally coincident occurrences, that is, from events happening at the same time. Events that reveal to the very blossom and tadpole the meaning of space and time. Things happen together. That's what makes the world make sense. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the 7th week of Middle Summer. In the meantime, notice how everything is happening together.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
This is WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Juliette Frumholt, and it's time for another WYSO Curious investigation. John Patterson, Edward Deeds, Wilbur and Orville Wright. Big names from a time when Dayton was a hotbed of innovation and invention. These guys prompted a question from WYSO listener Susan Thornton.
Why did Dayton produce so many inventors? For example, Charles Kettering, the Wright brothers, the pop-top can inventor.
For Why So Curious, Lewis Wallace popped open the answer, or actually, answers.
At Carillon Historical Park in Dayton, the video on loop in the lobby lays it out. In the early 1900s, Dayton was the invention capital of the United States.
Some of these inventions include the airplane, the cash register, the automobile self-starter, and the pop-top beverage can.
Mary Oliver and Alex Heckman, who work here with Dayton History, take me into a room filled from floor to ceiling with elaborate cash registers, each engraved with the words National Cash Register.
In my opinion, exactly why we're standing here is why Dayton was so innovative was NCR.
Oliver thinks National Cash Register is where a lot of it got started. John Patterson, who founded the company in 1884, didn't actually invent the cash register. He was an entrepreneur, and he surrounded himself with creative folks. Which brings us to the first, most obvious answer to Susan's question about why Dayton was a hub for invention. Dayton had the people. Alex Heckman.
Dayton had a particular group of people all in this golden era that were all coming together at the same time that really had that mindset.
Patterson hired engineers Edward Deeds and Charles Kettering, who went on to invent the ignition self-starter. Yeah, that one. But there's a chicken-egg question here. Which came first? Did the people make Dayton, or did something about Dayton make the people? And that's the thing. There is more than one factor. Factor number two, location, location, location. Janet Bednarik is a history professor at the University of Dayton. She says Dayton was near rivers and transportation. It was a good spot for making things.
There had always been a lot of machinists in the area, a lot of small-scale manufacturing, things that we call today tool and die.
Then as the industrial economy exploded, people were drawn here.
The late 19th and early 20th century was a time of tremendous technological change, a lot of energy, a lot of capital was available for innovators at that time.
Ding. A third piece of why Dayton became a center for invention, money. The steel industry, meat packing, and of course Patterson's booming cash register business were raking it in, says Bednarik.
That capital has to go somewhere.
Dayton at that time was kind of like the Silicon Valley of mechanical engineering. There was investment to support a whole class of inventors and thinkers, which fed into a final factor driving Dayton's inventiveness, collaboration. Professor Bednarik says the Wright brothers and Kettering and Deeds used to hang out and put their heads together.
It seems if you get a lot of creative people within close proximity to one another, it seems to have this synergistic effect, and a lot of things happen, and that's what happened in Dayton around the turn of the last century.
The turn of the last century, right. Dayton took off as the patent capital more than 100 years ago. But in a recent national report from the Brookings Institution, the city came in near the bottom of the list for patents, with negative growth in the last couple decades. Still, all of us live with ideas that came out of the Dayton area, whether it's the airplane, the ice cube tray, or the barcode scanner in a grocery store. In the lobby of the History Museum, Dayton native Greg Franklin says he's not sure what made the city a center for invention. Maybe some folks were just in the right place at the right time.
Dayton was good farm country, and they bought up the land, and their minds went to work of how to make it work better.
Barely 100 years after they transformed that farmland, a lot of those big industries uprooted and left. Even NCR moved on in 2009. I asked Franklin what's left of the old Dayton.
Seeing Dayton reinvent itself.
He says it could be possible to
bring it back to greatness like it was back in the day.
But that reinvention, he says, will have to involve everyone. For WISO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
Why So Curious is our series where you ask the questions and WISO reporters answer them online and on air. Go to WISO.org to submit your own questions about the Miami Valley's people, history, and economy, and weigh in on which question we should take on next. Dayton innovation proved crucial 100 years ago when the world was racing headlong into war in Europe. Aviation was a new and untried tool for military leaders, and it soon became a powerful weapon. Here's aviation commentator Dan Patterson.
In July of 1914, it had only been 10 years since the Wright brothers first flew at Kitty Hawk, and aviation was flourishing around the world. Aviators were flying longer and longer distances. Frenchman Louis Blériot crossed the English Channel. Air meets were drawing thousands of spectators to see daredevil pilots and their fast new planes. Large multi-engine aircraft were being built by Italian and Russian visionary aviators. They could carry passengers and, more ominously, bombs. The royal families of Europe were about to fight a war using military tactics that were 100 years old. Even though the Industrial Revolution had created very efficient battlefield machines and lethal chemicals, long lines of infantry and cavalry were about to be slaughtered by machine guns and poison gas. Airplanes were very basic when the war began. Even though they were small, frail, underpowered, and difficult to fly, both sides started using them on reconnaissance missions to see beyond the battlefields to where the enemy was gathering and to determine the targets for new and larger artillery that was blasting the countryside into an unrecognizable moonscape. An American pilot, James McConnell, flying for the French Squadron No. 124, the Lafayette Escadrille, described the countryside of Verdun in northern France as a sinister brown belt, a strip of murdered nature. It seems to belong to another world. Every sign of humanity has been swept away. The first observer pilots were armed only with cameras, but that soon changed, and cameras were exchanged for pistols. What began as friendly waving between aviators became gun battles in circling aircraft at surprisingly close range. The air war was developing. Soon those observation airplanes were being escorted into battle by smaller and faster airplanes to pursue the enemy, creating fighter aircraft and the fighter pilot. Stories of the so-called Knights of the Air made rich material for writers and filmmakers. But the bravado of their endeavors and the joy of dancing among the clouds was swiftly replaced by the grim realities of death. The evolution of aviation was paid for in blood and lives. With fighters as escort, the observation planes began to carry bombs. In fact, early bombs were just artillery shells. Soon the bombers began to attack factories that made weapons and then cities. Citizens were no longer far from the front lines. The air war ushered in the modern war, which was total war. Between 1914 and 1918, the advances in aviation, driven by total war, created airplanes with larger and more powerful engines, making for bigger and faster airplanes, which carried more and flew further. The First World War transformed aviation, and soon after the war ended, Bombers became commercial airliners, and fighter planes became air racers. Countries large and small boasted of their airborne accomplishments and their aviator heroes. The whole world began to watch the skies, expecting miracles. For WYSO, this is Dan Patterson, wishing you blue skies and tailwinds.
Dan Patterson is an aviation historian and photographer. You can see photos of some of the surviving aircraft used in the early days of World War I at our website, wyso.org. Aviation programming on WYSO is supported in part by the National Aviation Heritage Alliance and the Air Force Museum Foundation. That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on member-supported 91.3 WYSO Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. I'm Juliette Frumholt. Jerry Kenny will be back next week. Thanks for listening to WYSO Weekend. The Book Nook is next.